nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
My name is Mark Lundstrom, and I'd like to welcome you to the first of a year-long series of seminars on the topic of connecting nanoscience and the life sciences. This is a topic that a lot of people are interested in and thinking about. There's a lot of work here on campus at Purdue by people trying to make this connection. And in particular, two of the centers that we have here on campus, the Network for Computational Nanotechnology and the Institute for Nanoelectronics and Computing, are sponsoring this year-long series as a way to help us think through where we're headed in this area. And we're just delighted to have one of the leaders in the field here with us this morning to kick this series off. But before I introduce him, I want to make two quick announcements. We're on an extremely tight schedule. Space is scarce at Purdue right now. There's a class here, I think, at 10:30. We have to finish and be out of the room by 10:25. But the second announcement is we have a reception. This is a beautiful building. Join us upstairs, third floor, for a reception. You'll be able to ask your questions and talk with our speaker at that time. So I encourage you all to do that. Our speaker this morning is Professor James R. Heath. He's the Elizabeth Gulen Professor at Caltech, Professor of Chemistry, and he's also with the Department of Medicine at UCLA. He did his BS at Baylor, and he did his PhD in chemistry at Rice, where he was a key student involved in the work on C60 and the fullerenes, and that was the work you all know led to the Nobel Prize. He spent some time at Berkeley and at IBM Watson, and then joined UCLA in 1994. And in the year 2000, he was able to create the California Nanosystems Institute there at UCLA, and that continues there. Professor Heath is now at Caltech. He's been working on a number of topics. One of those is molecular electronics, and that's a field that we in electrical engineering have followed with great interest. And recently, he's been applying that work to problems in cancer detection and infectious disease, and that's the subject for this talk today. So please join me in welcoming Jim.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me turn the lighting down. Can you hear me and see what I'm talking about? So we're in good shape. All right. So today I'm going to talk to you about a project that we've been working on in my group now for not really that long. In fact, I moved to Caltech specifically to try to get this project done. But we've made a fair amount of progress over the past year, and largely over the past 2 years, largely the progress we've made has been because this is not just me. There's several of us involved in this. I think Lee Hood was here last year. And so the folks involved, there's three that are at Caltech, myself, Mike Rukas, and Steve Quake. There's a couple of oncologists and immunologists, Owen Witte and Charles Sawyers. And at Institute for Systems Biology, there's Lee Hood and Alan Adiram. And the work I'll talk to you today is largely work between my group and Lee's group, but the knowledge that what we've learned has been just the fact that we've been teaching each other consistently over the past 2+ years on this project. So this is probably a slide that you saw when Lee was here. And, you know, I think when you talk about, do you hear me when I stand here? Okay. So when you talk about how we bring together nanotechnology, engineering, or whatever with biology, I think the one great gift biologists can give you is a well-defined problem to work upon. And you know, that's something that I think is foreign to much of us who never took a biology class. And so that's really where I'm going to start. I'm going to try to describe this problem. So over the past few years, really, formally, I guess, once the genome was sequenced. But since that time, high-throughput methods have enabled biologists to begin capturing many of the elements in a biological system. The genome is fully sequenced in many organisms, including the human. The mRNA, which codes for the proteins that carry out the instructions of the genome, there's increasingly good ways to completely quantify those, and I'll talk about a completely quantitative method for that. Proteins are a little harder, but methods for capturing those are becoming important, and all the way up to ecologies. And if you think of a disease, and I'll talk about cancer in this talk, if you think of a disease like cancer, you can appreciate that all of these levels are important because where you live can dictate your propensity to get a particular type of cancer, just like your genetic predisposition for that disease. So what you would like to be able to do is capture information at all of these levels and relate it back to, let's say, build a circuit or a network hypothesis of how a disease or how an organism functions. And there's two effects that you have to worry about. One is a bottom-up effect, such as a genetic mutation that might lead to cancer. And the other is a top-down effect. This is an environmental perturbation. Food you eat, where you live, chemicals you're exposed to, sunlight, etc. And, you know, biology is unique. It's separate from physics and chemistry in that in biology, you start off with a digital genome. You actually have a code that you know. And so if you take information at all these levels and continually don't treat it as phenomenology, but relate it back to this digital code of the genome, then what you're learning is fundamental and implies that, in fact, this field, although it looks chaotic at the moment, is perhaps knowable. And so the way that is done is through collecting information at all these levels, integrating it into, with software packages, because, for example, the genome is known. If you see a protein, if you sequence a peptide and a protein, you can identify which gene that protein comes from. And so you can couple all this information together, correlate proteins according to they're generated from the same transcription factors or protein-protein interactions, etc., and come up with a model for a system. And this is such a model. For predictive models, this is a network model, predictive network model for a biological system, they've been established for just a couple of organisms, single-cell organisms, that where the genome is fully sequenced and where you can capture all the mRNAs and many of the proteins. But out of such a... I guess we're not quite fully on the screen, but it's okay. So, for example, for yeast, this is a model, a network hypothesis model for yeast. And yeast has 6,000 genes. It's a pretty soluble problem. It's a pretty homogeneous system. There's been a huge amount of literature data made, come out in the last few years. But out of this network model, what you find is some fundamental lessons that you can translate to a human model. So, number one, if you perturb the yeast, say by a genetic knockout, you affect approximately, say, 15, 20, 30% of all the molecular elements in the system through a single perturbation. And so that tells you that something like a disease, which is a perturbation, or a drug, which is a perturbation, can be detected by some pattern of genomic and proteomic information. The changes are dynamic. So that if you perturb the system and you look at it now, and you look at it an hour and a day and a week later, that evolves. And so the progression of this disease, or the progression of how the perturbation is affecting the system, the drug effect, whatever, is also something that's extractable. And so that has to do with both genomic and environmental perturbations. What's really exciting from a clinical point of view is that at least in this system, and I'll talk to you about prostate cancer and breast cancers as well, is that because you can look at all this information and compare it against databases, you can say, well, if we perturb it, let's say we take a prostate cancer cell and we perturb it with androgen, which is a treatment for early stage prostate cancer, then of all the proteins that are perturbed, about 15% of those code for secreted proteins or secreted peptides. So that means that it's possible to capture this fingerprint without even going into the cell, by looking at the surrounding of the cell. Another thing, and this is something that I think is very misleading when you have biologists that are talking about doing gene expression arrays, like Affymetrix chips, to try to identify cancer markers, is that the chance that a protein is going to be upregulated because the mRNA concentration goes up is about 50-50. Because there are many, many post-transcriptional modifications, many regulatory processes in biology which will turn on, which will cause a protein to go down when the mRNA goes up, or vice versa. And so that's an issue in trying to capture a full system, is that you can't just look at one of the components. You have to look at all of it, or you miss this regulatory biology. So, for example, this is a picture of yeast in which, if there's a pointer here, is there a pointer here? So at the top left, you see a green, and that ball represents a protein or an mRNA. And these proteins are basically clustered into modules, each of which you can assign some physiological function to, some metabolic function. So that gene was knocked out. That's called if it's sitting in the middle of one of these modules, it's called a transcription factor. And pretty much every single thing you see on here was perturbed. And so imagine that's a perturbation. So out of this, you can identify not just the primary effect of a drug, but you can imagine the secondary effects as well. And furthermore, by capturing all the elements of the system and integrating them like this, you can see these critical nodes, such as these transcription factors, which emerge as what would be, say, critical drug targets. And so for cancer, the cell cycle would be an obvious drug target. Okay. So we have all this wonderful technology. We have the human genome sequenced. And yet the translation of that into something that can actually clinically impact the health of patients has been very slow. In fact, it's you see a couple of scattered examples of it now, but it's pretty much non-existent. And the reason, well, here's an example. I think one of the most profound examples, a very heavily studied cancer. In the early 70s, President Nixon declared a war on cancer, which did many things. It said that we as a nation are going to go after and solve this problem. In the early 70s, if you had suspected you had breast cancer, you had a mammogram. They would find a lesion, such as what's indicated in that graph. They would operate and remove it. They would do some simple tests. If it was cancerous, they would follow up with radiation and chemotherapies. Today, if you think you have breast cancer, it's pretty much the same thing. And in fact, even though the detectability and curability rate, which is a statistic of breast cancer, seems to have gone up, the actual numbers of deaths from breast cancer has not changed. And yet a lot from these methods that I've talked about before, a lot is known about breast cancer that wasn't known before. And so, for example, there's typical data. You can look in many papers and find graphs like this. You don't have to know much biology. You just have to do pattern recognition. So on these graphs, on the y-axis are patients and the x-axis are genes. And this is just gene expression data from a bunch of different breast cancer patients. And what you find is that the cancer actually is not just one disease. It's one clinical presentation, but it's multiple diseases. And you know probably from experience that this is so. You meet someone who has breast cancer and 2 months later, they have passed away. Or you meet someone who has it and becomes a chronic disease. And if you look at a circuit model of a cell, you can appreciate a little bit about why this is so. So this is a sort of a non-trivial model. And I'm not sure why I've circled that one. I think it's just a... Well, imagine that blue translucent circle is raised up a little bit. I wish I could point. Is there like a big stick? Well, maybe I can... If you look on this... Okay. So this pathway here, starting with RTK all the way in, is what's called a tyrosine kinase pathway. This is a picture of a cell where that's the cell wall, and this is the nucleus. And every single one of these sort of three or four letter abbreviations you see here stands for a protein. And so what happens at a signaling molecule will come in and bind to the surface of the cell. And it will cause this tyrosine kinase pathway to kick off. And so many reactions happen. Think of this as just a circuit, an amplification signal happening. And at the end, it sends a signal into the genome, which tells the cell to divide. Now, where you see red, that's a known genetic mutation associated with cancer. You have to have two to get cancer. But that red is effectively a short circuit. And so when you have your... And so what it means is that, for example, if on this pathway, let's say this RAS, just a little bit past that red RAS, just a little bit past the RTK, the RAS is a mutation. That means that you're independent of what happens upstream. So that pathway is always turned on in this case. But there's many ways that we can step into this pathway and short circuit it. It's like the lights are out in this room. You don't know if the light bulbs are out, the light switch is off, there's a circuit breaker off. Many, many different causes to get the light out, but one clinical presentation, the lights are out. And so coming and struggling against a system like this is quite complicated. And in fact, where there's arrows connecting the proteins, those are known. But you'll find, if you look in the literature, you'll find a paper that will connect any protein shown on here with any other protein. It's a highly interconnected system. Okay. So if you look at, go from a single cell organism to something that's complicated. So the human prostate cancer cells, there's 30,000 genes in the human genome. They encode for about 250,000 mRNAs. Compared to yeast, which has 6,000 genes coding for about 10 to the 4th mRNAs. It turns out that the critical methods that most biologists use right now for monitoring mRNAs are these affymetrix gene chips. And they actually miss most of the important biology. They miss the critical components, these transcription factors. And so, but there has emerged new methods that are critical. So what we want to work toward here is how do you capture all these elements? Where are we in determining a network model for disease, for something like prostate cancer? And how can we develop technologies to take advantage of where we are now? Okay? So this is an example of a digital gene expression method. It's called MPSS. And it measures mRNAs down to the level of about one or two copies per cell. Much more sensitive than anything else. Absolutely a quantitative method. And so what you see here are the digital outputs of such a measurement between an early stage and a late stage prostate cancer cell line. And so, for example, some of these cells in late stage are generated at about, say, 159 or 183 copies per cell, whereas in the early stage, they're generated at 0 or 1. Okay? So when you do this kind of analysis compared to a normal affymetrix chip, you capture roughly twice the number of mRNAs, but you capture 80% of the differentially expressed transcription factors that you completely miss with a normal library. These are the low signal-to-noise components. Okay? So out of such a thing, then you can begin looking at what's happening as the disease progresses. How is the digital code of the genome being affected by the disease? And what you find is that between say, early and late-stage prostate cancer, something like 15% of the mRNAs are very significantly affected. Between no prostate cancer and early stage, it's about the same. For proteins, protein's a tougher thing to look at. There's a recent paper by Rudy Abersold where he looked at roughly 1,100 proteins in prostate cancer, and looked at how they were responding to androgen. And so what I showed you before, these genes that get up or down regular, it looks like white noise. And what I show you here, which is proteins that are affected by this androgen therapy, it also looks like white noise. You see that about a third of them get turned up, about a third of them get turned down, about a third of them basically are somewhere in the baseline. Okay? But it turns out, coming back to this issue, connect everything back to the digital code of the genome. You can take this phenomena and you can assign physiological functions to these proteins because you know where they're coming from in the genome. There's a huge database of information. And when you do that, what you find is something much more interesting. You find that when you expose these cancer cell lines to this therapy, that every single protein associated with protein synthesis, all 85 of them are repressed. Every single protein associated with lipid, fat, and sterol metabolism is increased. And this pattern, this pie chart, would change between, say, early stage, no prostate cancer, late stage, therapy, etc. And it turns out if you do a second search and look for which of these proteins encode for secreted proteins, you'll find that it's once again about 15% of these. And so this is a signature of a disease responding to a drug. Just as it would be if I plotted a different set of data, a signature of the disease emerging or expanding. Okay, so that's one thing, is that you can actually collect all this information together and put a picture together. Here's another a plot that I think is really interesting. So a few years ago, when I was a graduate student, there was this book, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You probably read this, at least, we're all science geeks here, so I'm guessing most people have read this. And in this book, the Earth is a big computer, and it's supposed to be calculating the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And it comes up at the end with a number, 42. And so this actually calculation is like this. So what this does is it takes 80 million measurements. And each of those 80 million measurements was done by looking at, quantitatively, using this digital method, the genes that are expressed in every single organism, every single organ in your body. And then by comparing that database, you can find genes that are expressed just in the prostate or just in the breast. This is about half of the organs that were analyzed. And what you find is that about 100 of these genes were identified that basically are just prostate specific in this case. A similar amount for ovarian cancer. Half of them encode for secreted proteins. Okay, so once again, if you're looking at, say, looking into blood, and you find some of the proteins associated with these genes, that tells you that they came from the prostate. They should not be there in the blood. You go back to this sort of pie-like chart, and that gives you information about what the disease is that's progressing, how it's responding to therapy, et cetera. You don't have to look at 1,100 proteins. You just have to look at a statistical representation of those that are associated with, say, fat and sterile metabolism or protein synthesis. Okay, now looking in the blood is a tough thing to do, it turns out. And that's because in your blood there's something like 100,000 proteins with a dynamic range that's, you know, approaching something like Avogadro's number. And there's 20 or 30 proteins that dominate the mass, 99% of the mass, that are almost impossible to get rid of, like albumin. And you could really care less what albumin's doing in your blood in terms of its quantity. But it turns out these 20-some proteins have a post-transcriptional modification, a glycosylation process that allows you to grab them and pull them out. And so here's an example of looking at proteins from the blood, and by grabbing out, doing this chemistry, something that's described in this paper here by Abersold's group, you can get rid of these 20-some major proteins. You see 10,000 new proteins, and out of that, you find that many of these proteins that you want to find that are correlated with cancer now emerge out of the signal to noise, and you can identify them. And this is an example of just taking one of those proteins that we've identified. It was actually the one that was the Hitchhiker's Guide number, and looking and see how that correlates with prostate cancer. You see it in the blood, shouldn't be there unless something's wrong with the prostate, and looking at serum samples from patients out of the Fred Hutch Institute, what you find is that this is the normal. So if you're a male and you have white hair, you probably know what PSA is, because it's the major prostate cancer indicator. And PSA is a terrible indicator of early stage prostate cancer. Really, it's a protein that's supposed to be there, but it only gets into the blood when you have trauma to the prostate. So it's not really just cancer, it's any sort of trauma to the prostate. And so it doesn't detect, so metastasis would be such a trauma. And so it doesn't detect early stage prostate cancer. It does all right on late stage. But this protein that we've identified actually does a pretty reasonable job of early stage prostate cancer. And combined with late stage, it pretty much captures all of them. And there's 100 more to go, proteins that we've identified, and 300 genes that we could look at in a tissue biopsy, and the same type of information for ovarian cancer. So as you can appreciate, if you can measure 1 and you get some fidelity, you measure 10, you're going to get a root 10 better signal to noise. You measure 100, you're going to get root 100 better signal to noise. And so with the type of information that's been collected so far, it looks like it's probably possible to develop tests that are completely indicative of early or late stage prostate cancer, the tremendous amount of information associated with them. And it turns out if you can catch cancers at an early stage, at least this is what the NCI folks tell me, the vast majority of them can be cured. Okay, so let's talk about going back to this predictive network model for a human disease. So we have 80 million plus measurements of genes and proteins that we've done as compared to, say, 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 5th measurements that were done on yeast, and the problem is still highly underdetermined. But nevertheless, we've learned a lot, and we've learned enough that one can imagine having a significant clinical impact. And so let me talk about where I see some really tremendous opportunities for having that impact. And the first is to do informative diagnostics, to take a finger prick of blood, and to monitor for these 100 or so secreted proteins. And there's going to be different basis sets depending on whether you're looking at ovarian cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, uterine cancer, whatever. But so you may have to do 1,000 measurements if you want to capture all the major cancers. Identify the disease, identify the progression of the disease, the response to the disease, the therapy, etc. And then I want to talk about the second opportunity, which is, you know, why is this, after 80 million measurements, why is this prostate cancer model still so underdetermined? And I think that's where there's really hard, but also terrific single molecule, nanotechnology applications. So this is a platform that we've been developing over the past year, now that we actually know what to look for. And the idea is to take a finger prick of blood and to do these various operations on it. And so let me tell you what our vision is here. So, you know, if people have diabetes, they can monitor their insulin all the time. And that does wonderful things for the disease because they have this feedback, they can take control of the disease by modifying their diet, their lifestyle, everything else. Cancer, there's no such way to do that. But with looking at these 100 proteins, being able to correlate them back with the metabolic processes they're associated with, there ought to be a way to give patients the ability to do with a very simple test, just like a diabetes-like test, maybe with some exotic telemedicine involved, the ability to take control of the disease in ways that you simply can't do now. And so the package we're trying to develop is that's the goal of it, is to make it that simple, like a pregnancy test. Okay, so let's talk about on this thing we've learned from Steve Quake, the beauty of integrated microfluidics, which allows us to imagine putting all of these things onto a small chip. Blood handling, serum purification, cell sorting, proteomics, and genomics. And so let me show a movie that comes from Steve Quake's lab, but I'll show you devices that we've made that couple silicon-based technologies with these things to show you the power of this. So this is it's all soft, multi-layer elastomer microfluidics. If you look here, these three things here that cross, these constitute a pump. There's another pump here, 1, 2, 3. And where you see just one, it's a valve. And so when you, this is dealing with about 100 picoliters of fluid at this point. But what it allows you to do is to introduce components, molecular components, to stir them, to mix them, to do reactions, etc. And in fact, we use this now for many reasons, for serum purifications. We use it to automate the construction of protein chips. We use it to make molecular probes that are useful for imaging and localizing the disease of cancer. So this is an example of a serum purification chip that my student Gabe Kwong built, where we take this glycosylation chemistry that allows you to look into the blood and get rid of these major proteins. And we just reduce that into the chemical steps onto one of these fluidic circuits. And so these are the various steps that are necessary. There's 4 steps, including there's a column that's loaded that traps the heavy mass proteins. And then it's kind of, you don't get a lot of material, but you get enough that you can do a gel and identify this is where those 10,000 proteins are that are hard to see. These are the major proteins like albumin and et cetera that we separate in this environment. Okay, so this is not my result. I want to talk about both proteomics and genomics out of this. This is from Steve Quake's group, but it just shows the power, once again, of these fluidics. It's not particularly scalable at this level in terms of many measurements, but it's good if you're looking for a particular genetic mutations associated with cancer. So here's a case where a single cell is introduced, and in the cell is lysed. There's a PCR column that's loaded. The signal is amplified, and out of that then, if you look at these columns, column 3 is just one cell, gene expression from one cell. Column 4 is 5 cells. Column 5 is just a laboratory control, and the other columns are various controls. And the advantage, this is a similar type of chip, not exactly the same, but close. But now here's 400 of these experiments done on one of these chips in a throwaway platform. So if you're looking for some of these key genetic mutations, this would be 200 patients with controls, basically 100 microliters of blood total, not per patient. This is a protein chip, but I'll talk about the chemistry that we use to construct this. But this is a protein chip now where we're scaling it to look at about 20 proteins here, but it will tell you how we can scale it to look at many more. The circular pumping region, which is very similar operated like you saw before, is what we use to not just automate the construction of this chip in ways I'll talk about, but also we use it to introduce the blood and to develop the chip. Okay. And so the other opportunity is to try to figure out why is this problem so undetermined? And what is it that we can do to bring this problem to something a little more determined, this network model of disease? And this, it basically is the difference between yeast and a human being, is that you have in a human being a tremendous amount of heterogeneity, not just from cell to cell, but across tissues. And so this is a pretty ideal situation. These are white blood cells, macrophages that are eating yeast. This is a movie taken by one of my students, Yuri Bunimovich. And so you look in this model, there's cells that are dividing. There's a cell that's just reached out a foot and ate a particle. There's this one cell at the bottom left that's balling up into a tight fist and is going to go looking for things. So all of these are going to have completely different signatures in terms of their protein and gene expression data. Here's an example of two identically cultured mast cells exposed to an identical stimulation sitting right side by side. One of them has gone into oxidative mode, and so there's a fluorescence probe that indicates that, and the other is granulating. And so when you do these proteomics and genomics measurements, you never ever capture this heterogeneity of the system. You also don't capture the time evolution of these responses. And I think that's where nanotech and clever engineering can have a significant role. And so the time evolution of the responses is something that one can put lots of numbers on. And the way I think about it is, you have bonds that can make and break in femto and picoseconds, and you have people that grow old and die over the period of a century. But I think the relevant number is in this picture of the cell where I showed these cancer mutations. How long does it take a molecule in that one of those pathways to find another molecule? And those molecules are in an electrolyte environment, which means that they're shielded from each other. Only diffusion is how they meet each other, effectively. And so diffusion inside of a 10-micron cell is about a tenth of a second. So that's really where you would like to go in terms of looking at a movie of this process. Okay, so these are the suite of technologies that we've been constructing. Mike Rukas is doing the nanomechanics. I talked about Steve Quakes is plumbing everything. And then these other two electronic detection schemes that are being developed in my group. And so I'm going to talk just about a couple of these. And the first one is a really simple one. It's an extraction of an extrapolation of an existing electrophysiological technique. But when coupled with these microfluidics and parallelized on a chip, it has many, many new applications. And so it's just electrophysiology called patch clamp, the first single molecule experiments ever done. And I think Nayer and Sackman won the Nobel Prize for this method. But it's typically done with a pipette. And so the chip, The way we have constructed this to get down to single cell resolution of the cells we want is coupling it with microfluidics. We put this type of a shape, of funnel shaped channel here that focuses the cells, and so that we can take a particular cell and bring it down onto the pore that we've micromachined through a silicon wafer. And this pore is, I tell you, this pore is really, really non-trivial to make if you're trying to get the gold standard, which is a gigaohm seal. But if you look at the architecture of this device, on the bottom is microfluidics and on the top is microfluidics. When the cell comes down, we rupture the membrane right here. So through the bottom, we have chemical access to the inside of the cell, and through the top, we have chemical access to the outside of the cell. What that allows you to do is to look at all the membrane proteins, which it turns out are very disease sensitive, that are electrically active, and to titrate both the inwardly and outwardly rectifying channel proteins. And so identify and quantify about a half a dozen different proteins on a single cell. And that's enough, actually, to do quite a bit. And so this is just examples of doing that. And so this is not a fully mature technique, but it works pretty well now. So that's just a handful of measurements, but it turns out it's a handful of measurements on proteins that are that don't get secreted, but are remarkably good indicators of disease. This is what I think really scales to high numbers of measurements with some serious engineering and materials challenges, but it's nanowire sensors. And so there's been a lot of beautiful work by Charlie Lieber done on silicon nanowire sensors. They were first really discovered by Hanji Dai at Stanford a few years ago. And the way they work is the following. So this is, I've mixed and matched some pictures, but on the left is data that my postdoc Peter Willis took. So you take a silicon nanowire, if it's really small, then it turns out it becomes sensitive to its chemical environment. So normally you think like a field effect transistor has got a source and a drain and a gate voltage that you apply to modulate the conductivity. Well, a chemical potential is the same units as a gate voltage. And so a change in the chemical potential near the vicinity of the wire will also gate it like a transistor, if it's small enough. And so here's where you imagine putting an antibody, you bind, and this is exactly the experiment that we and others have done, you bind a target protein to the antibody, and the conductivity changes. And here we discriminate between selective and non-selective binding by washing off the non-selective ones. And it turns out, for this process to work, the wires really need to be small. So a lot of times you ask, well, what is good about nanotechnology? It just looks like a really small version of other things. Well, here's an example where you simply can't do it unless the wires are of an appropriate size. And so if they're about 10 nanometers in size, you optimize your signal to noise. If they're too small, it's too noisy. And if they're too big, you simply you lose sensitivity. So the problem is, now, if you look at, so just do a web search on nanowires and nanowire devices and nanotube devices, you'll find that there's a lot of papers on single devices. And single devices work marvelously. The best transistors in the world that have been made, I believe, are nanotube transistors made one at a time. And if nothing else, I've tried to argue that if you're just going to measure one thing, you're wasting your time on this problem. You actually need to measure many, many things. And so the problem comes is how do you scale to the ability to 1,000 measurements? You don't have to do the 80 million, but you probably have to do this 1,000 measurements at a single cell level to get interesting information. You want to do it in real time, and so the circuit has to be really, really small because it can't be much bigger than the footprint of the cell, because remember this diffusion length is what dictates the time that we care about. So that argues that you're going to have to make a circuit that is smaller than you can get to with even the best E-beam lithography, and has got to be very reproducible from device to device. So this is a memory circuit we developed for something else, but that's to scale. And so that's a memory circuit at about 10 to the 11th bits per square centimeter using 10 nanometer silicon and 10 nanometer platinum wires with molecular switches in the junction, compared against a 10 micron macrophage cell. So the way that we make such circuits is because you can't use lithography to get to these dimensions, at least not cleanly, and certainly not to the densities. You can't approach it with it in terms of densities, is that we use gallium arsenide algas superlattices, which you can just encode to be exactly to atomic level the thicknesses that you want. And since gallium arsenide is different from algas, one's a metal, one's a semiconductor, you can etch one away and keep the other. So when you etch it, you turn it on its side, it has this comb-like structure. And then we evaporate metal in an E-beam evaporator just to the tips of right here, and then transfer that metal to a substrate as an ink. And if the substrate is Cymox, then we can etch through and make silicon wires. And so these are silicon wires. They're about 10 nanometer diameter silicon nanowires, patterned at about, this is about, I think, 35 nanometer pitch. But this goes down to 10 nanometer pitch in 5 nanometer wires. And they're almost atomically straight. They're really beautiful. And if you look at this picture, there's 128 wires across here, which would translate into about 500 sensors in the footprint of a cell. And there's no defects in this process. And if you look at them compared to pretty good E-beam lithography, which we used in this case to wire them up, you see these wires, this lithography is big stubbly fingers that look noisy and, you know, kind of nasty on the scale. These wires, which are in this case about 30 atoms across, are on the other hand, pretty perfect. And so we've done a lot of work to try to get these things to be really wonderful conductors and to control the doping and things like this in these wires. And I'll tell you that, you know, the normal processing methods that you would ever use to do silicon kill you in terms of conductivity when you get to these dimensions. So when you do, for example, ion implantation doping, you leave defects. If your wire is 10 microns long and 10 nanometers wide, you always find one of these defects, and it just kills your conductivity. So you can't do ion implantation doping. The typical etching tools, the powers and the frequencies, damage silicon at a level that if you're at these dimensions, you can't get conductivity. And so we developed a process for these wires that was an old process called spin-on-glass, coupled with a high-frequency etching tool that we constructed that allows us to sustain a plasma at 1 watt. And by doing that, then we can get bulk-like conductivity values even down to these dimensions of 10 nanometers. And so this is the industry standard SOI wafer. There's an MBE wafer, and the non-industry standard, we actually detect that it's not perfect in this process, but we get bulk-like conductivity. And we actually begin to see fluctuations associated with the numbers of dopant atoms in the in each wire. But we can control the doping to the extent that we can also do PN junctions and control the doping through the wire, which is useful for some of the processes I'll talk about. So now you've got these wires that look like they're going to be good sensors because we have great control over them, and they're actually pretty good transistors. But they're too dense to address because you get these big, numbly fingers that don't want to reach into this world. And so the way that we have decided to go after this, and that's actually working to some extent, is using an approach like this. So this is called a binary tree multiplexer, which has a standard advantage of all binary tree multiplexers, that if you have 2 to the 10th wires, like 1,000 wires, you only need 10 wire pairs to address any single wire. Okay? It has logarithmic scaling. So the big wires, you need a few of them to address many small ones. But also notice a couple of things. Notice that the smallest structure here, which is this bright green spot, is a lot bigger than the smallest nanowire. And the spacing is a lot farther apart than the smallest nanowire. And in fact, it can be arbitrary. And also notice that this pattern of brights and darks continues beyond where the nanowires are patterned. And in fact, that's intentional, not just a drawing mistake. And what it implies is that wherever we stamp this down, as long as we get the angle right, it's going to work. Okay? So the way it works is the following. Where there's bright green, we have a high-K dielectric, a very thin high-K dielectric, and this input here will gate the nanowires. It'll pinch off conductivity. So we put all the wires high here, and then we apply an address. So if these two are complementary inputs. So this is a high, that's a low. So this would be, a 1, a 0, a 0, a 0, and a 1. And so we pinch off the conductivity, the top half, and then a quarter, and et cetera, all the way down until just one wire is highlighted in the end. And we have the only thing we've lost here is that we don't know exactly which wire we've addressed. We just know the address of the wire. Each wire is a unique address. But we don't have to know that. We just have to know the address of our wires. Okay, so this allows us to bridge these link scales. This is a picture of this circuit drawn out, and you can see here the wires you can barely make out. You can see the contrast and resolution. Here you can just see the edge of this 128 wires. Here's a binary tree structure right here. There's the wires, and then everything else here is just test. And this is then the performance of a smaller version of that. And this is the shows the side view. So it's a 10 nanometer hafnium dioxide gate dielectric. This is two adjacent wires. One pinched off. The other this one here, this minus 3 volts, was a thick dielectric, not intended to gate it, and it didn't change. But this one was able to pinch off. And then pulling many wires and trying to pull out just one wire out of the many. This is examples of just pulling out three different wires. And so this circuit works. Not perfectly yet, but it works well enough to do what I'm about to talk about. So now you've got these wires that look like great sensors. You've got a real ability to reach in and electrically touch each one. But they're still dumb wires. They don't know anything about the proteins they're supposed to sense. The only way you can do that is by putting a different antibody on each wire, or a different DNA complement if you're looking at genes. And so you have to find a way not just to reach in and electrically address them, but to make every wire different. And if you look at the existing methods, they don't even come close. And so the standard is to spot molecules down with either optical lithography or some sort of a spotting technique with the inkjets. Chad Merkin, just a little bit north of here, has developed a really beautiful technique called dip pen, but even these structures are much, much bigger than the circuits that we're talking about. And so we take advantage of the electrical control that we have over the wires. So I want to walk through this and on how we've developed this chemistry, and I want to I'll make a point at the beginning of this and to justify sort of detail of some of these measurements. You know, when you buy a chemical from Aldrich, it costs like 1,000 times more than if it's electronic grade than if it's not. And there's a reason for that. With electron materials, you got to do really, really high-level processing. And when your electronic device is only 10 nanometers wide, it really matters where all the atoms are. Okay? So here we've just taken... We take a chemistry where we start off with an H-terminated or a chlorine-terminated silicon wafer. This is 111, although I'll compare 1-1-1 and 100. Okay, so we start off with a surface like this that's pretty well characterized. And now we want to use electrochemistry to construct our protein chip. And so because of that, and because we want to have a good sensor, we need to remove the oxide from the silicon. Because number one, the oxide, if you try to put a voltage on the silicon wire, it dissipates that voltage before it gets to solution, so you can't do electrochemistry. And number two is that the sensing event you want to feel here, and that oxide separates you from that event, and it also adds an isoelectric point, a lot of negative charge on the surface of the wire. And so we take either a hydrogen or a chlorine terminated surface, and we take an alkene, a double bond with heat or UV light and attach it, or we take a Grignard reagent and attach it. And so to work this out, we took the very simplest version of this possible, which was just a methyl group and a Grignard reagent, attached methyl group onto the surface. And so this is methyl groups that are now sitting with pretty good registry, actually perfect registry on top of silicon, imaged at 77K. When you go down to 4K, the methyl group stops spinning. And you can actually see this threefold symmetry structure you see here is that of a methyl group. And so those are the hydrogen atoms that have just stopped, like propellers. They just stopped spinning and locked into place. So out of this type of a measurement, we get a really good feeling for how to take these surfaces and really wonderfully passivate them to a level that is at what we need for the types of circuits we're making. So then we take this molecule here, which is a hydroquinone, and we bind it to the surface using a double bond on the surface. And this molecule has a wonderful property that Mylan Merkshus, also just north of here at Chicago, demonstrated on gold surfaces, that you can flip it back and forth between a hydroquinone and a quinone. And so putting that onto a surface, then, that's what this picture is. This just shows that we basically retain the high-quality surfaces even after putting this hydroquinone on it. The coverage on 100, so for you guys who are engineering, 100 is a relevant surface, even though 111 is a great surface, because that's where the wafers come. And so you get about half the coverage on 100 was 111, but it's still a pretty stable surface. When you oxidize the hydroquinone to the quinone, then you have chemistry that's available, two chemistries. One is Michael's addition, which is this addition of a thiol to this quinone, and the other is a Diels-Alder addition. And so doing that chemistry then, and automating it, is how we basically build this chip. So we take these wires, we strip off, we put every single identical molecule in every single wire, and then we electrochemically activate the wires and just construct this chip sequentially, one after the other, and do it while we go home. Okay. So let me just finish by saying that our stage one is we want to be able to take these tools and do an informative diagnosis via finger prick. And then once we get to single cells, to be able to basically begin addressing what this network looks like, and finally go to identify critical nodes that give us imaging probes of disease. So let's talk about this technology becomes important for imaging probes. So this is the most common imaging probe for looking at metabolism, and you make it in a microfluidics environment, and you can make it in about a factor of 50 faster with a yield that's about a factor of 2 higher than in a standard environment. And what this allows you to do is completely free up your chemistry, and especially when you use these types of circuits to make many, many different molecular probes, because you can do the chemistry so quickly. So this is a circuit designed, not by a chemist, it's a little awkward, designed to make one of these molecular probes where the reactions are laid out in this particular sequence using these soft elastomer microfluidics. And going back to this initial model of prostate cancer and this collective database, by looking at comparing this information to a database, we find that a particular metabolic process is particularly expressed at a high level in late-stage prostate cancer cells. That gives you a molecular imaging target to bring a molecule in and not only localize that cancer, but in the patient without even taking blood out of them to identify perhaps cancer metastasis, but certainly late-stage cancer. And but you can't imagine doing this unless you have the freedom to make these molecular probes extremely rapidly. So that's how we eventually imagine taking this to the patient beyond just the diagnostics. So I thank you for your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll put up those people who did the work.
So I want to thank Jim for a great kickoff to this series. As I mentioned, we need to vacate the room, but Jim is going to be around. There's a one-hour reception on the third floor. I'm told that it's in an open area that we can't miss it. So I'd encourage you to join us up there and speak with Jim. And we have a little memento of his visit here at Purdue, and we'll ship this if you can't carry it with on the airplane.
Thank you. Beautiful. Could you ship it?
You can ship it.
Okay.